Would you prefer me to just dial up right now on the phone?
No, you can wait however you want to do it. You can, I would actually prefer you not do that right now just because there might be two or three more people who are trying to figure out how to get into the meeting.
Okay.
But we can do it. If you feel when I say let's do the prayers now, if you feel like let's make the phone connection, then just speak up and we will do that.
Can't Marilyn join by the phone number in the link?
Yes, she can do that. I think you can stay on video and mute yourself and then just hit the phone number link. And then you will get your audio through the phone.
All right.
Right, but I'd have to dial the phone because I'm using a computer, so I can't hit the phone link. I have to
Oh,
dial
you
it
don't
on
have a
the phone.
smartphone? You don't have a smartphone?
Yeah, I have a smartphone.
Can you get your email on the smartphone?
I can just.
If you get email on the smartphone, you can open up your email and
Well,
put the link
can
there.
you hear? Can you hear me okay or
Yeah.
not?
Yes, I can. Hi, Deidre.
Hi, I can't see you, but
I
I can
will.
hear you.
Oh, I wonder why.
I'm trying to figure out whether you want me to go ahead and phone now or not.
No, I don't
I
want
think
you
I'm
to
going to
phone
go
me.
ahead.
I do not want you to
Okay.
telephone me right now. Do not telephone
Okay.
me right now because we may have a couple of other people who use the wrong link and end up in the other non-existent meeting. And they would need to be able to call me. Are you able to hear me, Marilyn? Does that make
I
sense?
can hear you, yeah.
Okay.
That's all I care about.
Okay, so you're saying that you don't have a smartphone that you can get your email on so that you can click a link and join audio by phone.
I have the number right in front of me. I can
Okay.
do it by plugging it in, punching
Okay,
it in to the
if
computer.
that works for you, that's a little bit better than the speakerphone thing because it's good for my phone to be free in case somebody has a glitch. Also, a little addled this morning just because I didn't have, like, my routines are a little off. One of our Sangha members who's been ill for many years died this morning.
Oh, who?
Her name is Scarlett Sams, and please pray for her.
Well, I'm not getting the sound.
Okay, but you can still hear me through the computer?
It's very ragged.
Okay.
I think if you dial the phone number, it goes to the meeting and not to your phone, Mama. So,
He calls my number, it goes to my number. If she dials the number that's in
oh,
the email for
really?
Yeah, that's what I just did.
then she
Oh.
joins the meeting. Richard, you're doing sound through your phone, Richard?
Yeah, but when I dialed your number, I got you.
Yeah.
Instead of the, I got your house.
Oh, I didn't see that you called.
Were talking a second ago. Oh, maybe it was over here. You told me to go back to my mail.
Oh, yes, we did. Right. I remember
Yes.
now. All right. Well.
Well, I didn't know that about Scarlett.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so you get the emails from Kate Roy, right? Maybe you just haven't checked yet.
I haven't checked, but I
Yeah.
know she wrote me back last night. Did she? Was that this morning she died?
Scarlett wrote you back last night. Yeah, she died at 9:20 this morning.
Okay, oh, I'm glad I wrote her.
Yeah, that's really great. I know it meant a lot to her. She I visited her Wednesday and she was dying. I mean, I think she had a death rattle.
Yeah.
Barely speak. And I just sat there and held her hand mostly. And yesterday she bounced back and had a lot of visitors and was really lively. And Kate Roy was like, well, I guess she's not that close. And then she died this morning. But there are so many stories in Buddhism. Like with the deaths of lamas and so forth, where they can be really ill for a long time, and like right before they die, they perk up and their color is good and they, look really great. And it's like in Buddhism, it's a known phenomenon. So I think Scarlett experienced that.
Her email was very short. I figured she was very sick.
You know? Yes, she can't. She can barely. I mean, yesterday she, you know, she's in a hospital bed and she has a bin for throwing up in because she was throwing up anything that went down. She couldn't lift her hand to reach that. Like right before I got there yesterday, Wednesday, she didn't have strength to lift her hand to get it, and she threw up all over the bed. And then she had to get up. Anyway, that I was, you know, I usually have a little time on Thursday to do my final preparation for the class, so that did not happen today. I guess we will start. Sorry for the late start. Sorry for the technological problems. But we learned something really valuable, which is don't worry if it says the wrong time, because that means nothing in terms of, like, the meeting will be open because it's the ID number of the meeting. So that's a very valuable thing to know, which I didn't know. So, Marilyn, how are you feeling about the sound? Do you feel like you want to do the speakerphone?
Well, right now it's working.
Well, why don't you just let me know? You know, just signal me that you want me to unmute you if you happen to be muted, and let me know that that's why you're waving me, and we will do the phone thing.
Okay.
But it is possible. I mean, I'm not sure, like, you may have a different situation, but generally it is possible to be on video through the computer, and then you just go on your phone and join your audio by phone, like Richard is doing today. So you don't have to worry about that now, but just, it is a possibility. All right, I'm going to mute everybody who's not already muted. And as always, you can unmute yourself if you have anything that you would like to say at any time. I will allow specific times for people to speak up, but if you have something to say when I didn't do that, just signal me to unmute you, or you can unmute yourself. Yes, Valerie.
Is there any directive about when you have your hands like in a prayer position? Is there like during these prayers, for example, do we just follow you?
You can just follow me. Generally, everybody does Taljor. That means palms together for the first prayers. All of those prayers, except for mandala, where you do the mandala thing. Dedication of merit is really completely up to the individual. Lama Norlin never did Taljor for dedication that I remember, but he does now. And we do it in our Tuesday night study group because Lama Depa always does it. So I just do it now, but you don't have to for dedication. And you never have to. It's completely up to you. All right. So everybody's muted. We're going to do our prayers. And we are going to start with the meditation today. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru for continent, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms. According to the different propensities of beings, please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. And I will do my sheet, and I don't know if you have printed out your your copy of the bodhicitta. But anybody who printed that out, we can all do the bodhicitta together after my prayers. Four dharmas of Gampopa. I pray for Dadan Senshin Tam Che Chilo, Dadan Senshin Tam Che Lo Chosu Drawer Zinji Love to Soul, Chalam de Drawer Zinji Love to Soul, Lam Cholpa Selwar Zinji Love to Soul, Trupa Yeshe Sucharwar Zinji Love to Soul. I pray for blessing, may my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing, may the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing, may the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing, may confusion arise as wisdom, and from the aspiration to excellent conduct. Lai ke dang lu dang nu chin ke, chulpam da dang mi ke nam dang, drava kunji draki jitsam har, tam chi ke du da ki chitento. In the tongues of nagas, yakshas, gods, those of demons and of humans too, in the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. So we can do the bodhicitta together. And I don't actually have that printed out in front of me, so if I get the first couple of words wrong, just plow on. To begin, let us give rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. Hi, Mark Hoyer. So, we will start today with the Two Wings of Awakening. Doesn't matter if you have the printout. If you have it, that's great. You can follow along if you would like to, or you can just enjoy it as a guided meditation. We're going to do... somebody said something? No. Okay, we're going to do it in a concise form, not to take too much time, but we're going to get started with it. We're starting a little late today, so. So first we set our minds toward meditation and our bodies toward meditation by straightening our spine, following any of the other meditation posture points that we can do and would like to, but mostly just have a straight spine and a relaxed body. All muscles not needed to support our posture are relaxed. And we begin by just touching on each of the four thoughts, the four reminders that turn the mind toward Dharma, the precious human existence, which was our first bodhisattva practice, just remembering how precious this opportunity is that we have to do Dharma study and practice. And then impermanence and death, this opportunity can end at any time. So we need to practice now. And then karma, it is our own actions that determine our fate, whether it's happiness, suffering, or liberation. So we need to pay close attention to our actions and each day examine our stream of being. And then finally, we bring to mind the suffering of samsara. Since there is no reliable happiness anywhere in confused existence, we must use this life to free ourselves and others from it. We're going to skip the guru yoga today. We can talk about that one later when we look at the meditation more closely. Just go straight into calm abiding meditation. But if it's helpful, we can bring our root lama or, you know, whatever teacher we feel closest to, or the Buddha or Chinrezi to mind. That they are present with us, empowering our practice. So for calm abiding, we will simply follow the breath for a moment or two, just bringing our attention to rest. Glad to see that Anne Sove has joined us. We're getting started late because of the slight glitch with the meeting link. So from calm abiding meditation, we just go directly into meditation on ultimate bodhicitta or wisdom, and it can be done in one instruction or in four steps. We're going to do the four steps, but not linger long on each one. So we begin by looking at all experience as a dream. These are slogans from the 7 points of mind training. Look at all experience as a dream. So that means right now we simply let the solidity of our experience fade a bit. More dreamlike, less solid. And really, like, this can be about tables and walls and, you know, and video screens and so forth, but really it's about our thoughts and judgments and beliefs. We're just letting go of whatever thoughts, judgments, and beliefs, opinions, and so forth we may be grasping onto that are influencing how we perceive our experience. And from that state of perceiving our experience as a dream, we turn inward to examine the nature of unborn awareness, meaning our awareness, which is unborn. It comes, doesn't come from anywhere. It doesn't have a beginning. Just look at the mind, and we can ask ourselves any one question to sort of really bring ourselves into a state of being in touch with our mind. And that could be, does mind have a color? And you don't find one. If you do find one, you can rest in that, but generally we don't. And so that just allows our mind to relax into this state of not being identified with anything. And then the next slogan, let even the remedy release naturally, just means let go of any concepts and thoughts we may have, that may have come up as we are doing these steps. Let go of any thoughts of dreamlike existence or mind having no, mind having being empty. Just let the thoughts go and rest there. And when we rest there, that takes us automatically into the last step. Rest in the essence, the basis of everything. I'm going to tell you something that isn't usually directly instructed, but I think it really helps. Is by essence, what we mean really is awareness. That's my understanding. So we're just resting in our awareness, which is the basis of everything. And we're just going to use that as a working interpretation for now. And without losing touch with that awareness that we're resting in, which permeates all of our experience, but we're usually not aware of it, staying in touch as best we can with that feeling of open awareness, we practice taking and sending. And I think everyone here knows taking and sending. You breathe in whatever causes suffering. You breathe out whatever brings happiness and relaxation and peace. We're going to do that for ourselves today. So do it for your own self. Any anxiety or pain or grief or anything that's causing you suffering in the foreground or the background, just breathe that in. And breathe out to yourself happiness, relaxation, peace, whatever you need. Thinking that really, you are really taking away the suffering, because I didn't say, but when you breathe in the suffering, you let it dissolve in the vast space of your Buddha nature. And the happiness comes from your infinite, the infinite resources of your Buddha nature. So we imagine that the suffering is actually decreasing and the happiness and peace are actually increasing. And now we're going to include everybody who's in the class, whether they're present with us today or not able to be present. Whatever obstacles or pain or suffering, emotional suffering or physical suffering, any of our classmates may have. We breathe it in and breathe out to them whatever will relieve it. We don't have to know what it is. It covers everything. We can still be including ourselves if that's helpful. A part of our attention is still in touch with that open awareness that is our own nature of mind. And now I'm going to ask that we all include our Sangha member Scarlett Sams in our Tonglen, who died this morning at 9:20. Any suffering, any negative karma, any fear that she may be carrying forward, we breathe that in and relieve her of it, and breathe out to her happiness, reassurance, peace, awareness. And everyone, her family, and everyone who's affected by her death. Anyone else who has died recently or is in the Bardo. Everyone who has ever died. Breathing in their suffering, letting it dissolve in our vast Buddha nature. Breathing out to them happiness and peace, wherever they may be. And now we expand our visualization to include all sentient beings, whatever suffering they may have. And now we think that all sentient beings, including ourselves, are completely free from suffering and completely liberated into our vast Buddha nature, complete awakening. We just feel what that feels like for a moment. And now we let go of any visualization, any thoughts. Come back to just open awareness or following the breath, whatever is more comfortable, or both. And now back to our class, already in progress. So that's how we're gonna start our classes from now on, and I'll give more instruction on the meditation either as we go along as we have time, or more specifically in a couple of verses from now. Well, actually a few verses from now. It's around verse 10, I think, when the meditation is actually introduced in the text. There's no explanation of it in the 37 practices. That's in 7 points of mind training. But it is referred to as if we already know what it is. So does anybody have any feedback, comments, questions before we start? You can either unmute yourself or you can wave and I will unmute you. Anne, can you angle your screen down a little bit so that we see you and not your ceiling? We can just see your eyes. Oh, there you are. There you are. Yes. Great. Nice to see you. Okay. So, as I said, because we had an event this morning in our Sangha, I didn't do my last round of preparation, so it may not be as smooth as we would like, but I have notes. So first I'm going to review the context for everybody. Not everybody's in every class, so we're probably going to do this very quickly at the beginning of most classes, that we are in the 37 practices of a bodhisattva, which is a 14th century text, very short text, 37 verses with a few extras at the beginning and end, by Jalse Ngulchu, Tokme Zangpo, we call him, using a commentary by Dingo Chense Rinpoche called The Heart of Compassion, and also as a subsidiary text, which some people find more helpful than the Dingo Chense, is Ken MacLeod's Reflections on Silver River. This is a lamrim, like the jewel ornament. It's a very concise lamrim, or steps on the path, how to become enlightened. And it's also a mind training text, like the 7 points of mind training and Shanti Deva's Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life. And in the introduction, the text starts out with a verse of homage and a verse of intention. The homage is to Chenrezig, who is the embodiment of compassion. So this practice is really about compassion. Also happens to be include wisdom, but it's in the mind training class of compassion training texts. And also the homage is to his root lama. So we think of whoever we think of as our root lama, we think of them as the same as Chenrezig. So that's like something we can all carry forward into every class and into our studies, that Chenrezig is empowering what we're doing here. Chenrezig is present with us. and then his intention is to explain how to be a bodhisattva, because that is the way that all Buddhas reached perfect awakening, is through knowing how to be a bodhisattva and following those steps. So that's what we're doing here, and it's important to keep that framework in mind. So silent pop quiz, I finally hit upon the way to do this, is like, I'm just going to call it a silent pop quiz, like nobody answers, but we all just look, we Google our mind and see if we can remember what is the first practice of a bodhisattva, which is the one that we covered last week and, you know, talked about a couple weeks before that briefly. So not the verse, it's not about reciting the verse, but just can you name it? And I'm hoping that everybody will continuously like accumulate the names. First practice is this, second practice is this. Very handy to, you know, when you need to Google your mind in the future, handy to have those. So first practice is study, contemplation, and meditation. Right. So last week, I gave you some homework, contemplation homework. So if anybody has anything they would like to share about this, we're going to spend a couple of minutes on it. We're on to the second verse. Let's chant the verse first. I think that would be the proper order. Let me find my sheet that has it, my updated sheet that has all the words as we have them. We are going to chant the first verse together, everybody muted, sadly, and then we're going to chant the second verse. And then we're going to talk about how we see this verse in relation to our own life. And then we're going to look at the commentaries. This precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat to navigate samsara's endless sea, and set myself and other beings free, for that without distraction day and night, to study, contemplate, and meditate, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And then the second one, the one we're going to discuss today. While those I love can stir up a tsunami, and those I hate can burn me up like fire, when I don't care, I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind. To give up all my habits and reactions, the homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. I think I actually had it as this homeland, but maybe it doesn't matter. Everybody have the homeland where I've dwelt from life to life? You have this homeland? Yeah, okay, I think I have it different. This is my own personal file, my sort of translation working file, so I just didn't update it here. This homeland, okay, good, because I like this better here. All right, so you can unmute yourself if you have a comment, if anybody wants to speak to whether this rings true. And I want to talk a little bit about that first line, while those I love can stir up a tsunami, because as I think about it, you know, it takes me weeks of going over and over and over for the translation to really, you know, I think be its best. And this is what first came to mind, but I realized that that could sound a lot like "those I hate can burn me up like fire," like it's a negative feeling emotion, like a tsunami, but it can really, in the Tibetan, it's like a current that carries you away. You know, it's like a current of being in love, falling in love, or a current of being just emotionally involved. This is about people that we love. So it could certainly feel like a tsunami. I mean, family Thanksgiving dinners often, you know, are tsunamis. But it's not meant to convey like a tsunami of something negative, like fighting or something. That can be included in it, but it's just being swept away by the current of emotional involvement with somebody. So you can give me feedback either here in class or by email if you feel like I need to rework that line, if it doesn't quite do it, and that's not too hard. So does this verse ring true for our lives? And any of the other questions? Anne's nodding. Anybody can unmute themselves or wave and I'll unmute you, but... I think we can all relate to this. Anne, are you trying to unmute? You're unmuted now.
Thank you. I just wanted to say I had printed it out and stuck it on my visor in my car so I could, when I was at a traffic light, learn it so I could memorize it. And I had a terrible week last week in my heart with a dear long-term friend. I was completely and totally beside myself. Uh-huh. And I was sitting in my car feeling just horrible. And I looked up on that visor and there it was. And it was perfect. And I just kept reciting it all week and it really helped.
That's a great story. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah, I mean, this 14th century monk speaks to the experience. Anybody else have anything to share about how this works with your life? Or we can go on to the next, you know, the next is what kind of, well, I don't think we need to go into, this was just something to think about. What kind of tsunamis can loved ones stir up? And obviously Anne got some pretty in your face experience of that this week. And what happens when someone you don't like pushes your buttons? Like, can it burn you up like fire? That's very true to the Tibetan. They both are. Just a tsunami is a little more specific than what the Tibetan says. At work, at family gatherings, in your sangha, tsunamis and burning fires happen all the time in all of these places. At least that's my experience. For the last one, and again, we're just speaking to our own experience before we get to the commentaries of the wise ones, or the, you know, more trained ones. We're all wise, but we just don't have as much training as Tokmi Zangpo yet. So the third one may be a little more obscure. When I don't care, I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind. And that is what the Tibetan says. Does everybody have a sense of what that's about? Like, what is when I don't care? This is like in contrast to being swept away by someone you love or burned up by someone you don't love, that you hate. What does it mean to not care? And what does it mean? Yeah, somebody. Yeah, Marilyn.
Going through the different translations, indifference is what Ken McLeod says.
Yeah.
So that's what I thought you were translating. And then, well, I'm going ahead now. We weren't supposed to talk about this.
About what?
But using the text. We were supposed to just be talking about our personal.
That's okay. Experience. If the text spoke to you, you can bring that in. Because there's no limits on what you can say in this segment.
Well, I just thought that indifference. I thought the dark delusion permeates my mind. Actually, takes in all of the three things that are mentioned: the love, the hate, and the indifference. I thought. So are you saying that dark delusion permeates my mind is only related to when I don't care, the indifference?
I'm looking at the Tibetan on this one. Again, that's the way that I read the text is that that's specifically related to that. But certainly I think you're making an excellent point that they all are, you know, they're all things that increase our delusion, like getting caught up in any emotions. So... How's it translated in Kenpo Tsultrim's translation? Desire for friends churns like water. Anger towards enemies burns like fire. In stupidity's darkness, you forget what to adopt and what to reject. So I do think, I mean, looking at the Tibetan, Longdor Jepe Timuk Munak Chen. So literally, like a really literal reading of that would be what to adopt and what to reject, meaning like the virtuous actions and the unvirtuous actions, what will free you and what will, you know, chain you. Longdor Jepe is forgetting. The Timuk, okay, so they're definitely linked. This is specific to this line. The dark delusion or darkness and delusion of forgetting, or which forgets. So I think the point here, and I've given this one a lot of thought, like what does this mean? It's like there's no, it's again, it's like the three sufferings. There's just no place in samsara that's free, where you can just get a break. So you're burning up with like fire because you're emotionally engaged with somebody who's pushing your buttons, or you're being swept away by a current or a tsunami, being emotionally involved with someone you love. So you decide you're going to just step away from it. Like, I'm just going to not care. I'm just going to like, so what are some things that we do in that situation? We might turn on the TV. We might just decide to go blank. Like, I'm just putting it out of my mind. I just don't care about these people anymore. We might use our drug of choice, you know, alcohol, drugs, that kind of dolceza. You know, gelato or, we dull our mind. So when we step away from emotional involvement in us, when we're still stuck in samsara, the way we do that is escape. And it tends to be dulling our mind more, which I think this means a specific kind of delusion of just not seeing. And I think this answers a question. These correspond to the three poisons, right? Attachment is the first one, those we love. Aversion is the second one, those we hate. And ignorance and indifference are, like, indifference represents ignorance here. And ignorance, like, okay, so then to review basic Buddhism, because it's really important here. Attachment and desire lead to what rebirth? Like strong desire, greed, attachment. This could be a silent pop quiz. If anybody wants to chime in, they can. John, I see that you're unmuted. Did you have something you wanted to say?
Yeah, I equate what you're talking about, dullness, to like torpor in meditation, where yeah. Your meditation's not going to be effective because you're in that just blank state and nothing's, yeah. You're not aware. So I just draw that. It just reminded me of that.
Yeah, same thing. Good point. So does excessive desire and attachment get you reborn as a hungry ghost? That's the mentality if you don't believe in the different realms, but just psychologically, that's the hungry ghost, always never being satisfied. Aversion to hatred gets you reborn in the hell realms. Where does ignorance get you reborn? Animal realm. So I think this crystallizes a lot of the teachings that I have not always in the past really completely made the connection. It's like dulling the mind in some way through indifference, through indulgence in habit or escape. That's what gets you reborn as an animal. me and an ant. What's the characteristic of an animal? Well, when Trungpa Rinpoche, I don't want to spend too much time on this because we won't cover our verse or the rest of the commentaries, but Trungpa does a very, the first time I encountered the psychological explanation of the six realms was in Trungpa's introduction to his translation of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And so he has a little explanation of how each one of the six realms can be a psychological state. And for ignorance, he said that the characteristic of animals is that they don't have a sense of humor. Okay, all right. I take Trungpa's word for that. I see that, you know, but what, well, it's a certain dullness of mind, right, that would not have a sense of humor. It's a certain lack of engagement, I guess, on a some kind, I don't know, you know, I'm still sort of circling around like the full meaning of this, but, or as John says, torpor in meditation, like Rinpoche, Lama Norla Rinpoche, when he doesn't, I haven't heard him say this in recent years, so people who've been with him for all may have heard him say this before, that when he teaches meditation, he used to say, you know, and this is what it says in the text, though he gave it a little spin, meditation is not sitting with a blank mind. And that is a concept that people come in with sometimes, that it's just making your mind blank, no thoughts, just blank. And Rinpoche always said that that's not meditation. Meditation is actually very sharp awareness, but relaxed. It's a relaxed, sharp awareness, total acuity. But he said it, people who meditate by making their minds blank are like the raccoon who just goes into hibernation. Like it's just like an animal hibernating. And he said, in next spring, same old raccoon comes back up out of the hole. Not changed in any way, no progress at all. So anyway, indifference is not, it's not a remedy. Not caring is not a remedy. It actually digs you in deep, just like all the other things, just like the emotions, the emotions that we identify as emotions. So here's the question, and this will be somewhat addressed in the commentaries, that I was wondering how people took it. Does he mean this literally? We asked that question of the first verse. Does he mean literally, without distraction, day and night, study, contemplate, and meditate? And we decided as a group that he did, that you can do it in one way or another throughout your waking consciousness, maybe even when you're sleeping. In some way, you can be in touch with Dharma. Does he mean this literally? Like, do we need to pack our stuff and get out? Deirdre already did it, so maybe she's ahead of us. Deirdre just moved, and Valerie moves all the time. So is that it? Is that it? And it, the answer may surprise you. If you read the commentaries, you know. But for us, is that it? Is that good? Is that what's going to help us? What is the problem we're trying to solve here? You know, if attachment gets us in trouble, and aversion gets us in trouble, and indifference, not caring, gets us into even more trouble. Like, what are we trying to solve? And what's the solution? Well, it's in the verse. The answer's in the verse. At least the answer, the solution is in the verse. I added the interpretive line, to give up all my habits and reactions, this homeland where I've dwelt from life to life. But just to be clear, with one exception so far, I have never added anything that wasn't in the commentaries as the basic meaning of it. So here, this is the way it's discussed most of the time, or at least some of the time, that what it really means is not packing up and leaving. But really, packing up and leaving doesn't solve it. And Ken MacLeod gives a very nice sort of story about that. It doesn't help. Yes, somebody's unmuted. Marilyn.
It reminded me, of course, of, you know, getting out of town and bringing all your troubles. But then it also reminded me of what people talk about when they go into retreat. I mean, I know Ken MacLeod talks about retreat, but people talking about being a 3-year, you're just dealing with your own mind still. Right. You know, that's what everybody says, and you've done it. So
I can give a personal.
You can report on that.
personal affirmation, it's worse because the distractions aren't there anymore. The things that mask our emotional, you know, afflictions are no longer there. We've lost our routines. We've lost our books. We've lost our TV. We've lost our Dolce Gelato. So it's just in your face, yours and everybody else's, but yours especially because you're in your room all the time. Three-year retreat is the place to see ego clinging. You never question what ego clinging is again after you've been in a long retreat. So yeah, you take it with you into retreat. You think you're getting away from it and you're not. So that's our, you know, that's how it feels to us. Does anybody have any other comments on like our experience of this? John?
Yeah, it seems that when you move to another location, you're still taking all your mental baggage with you. You're just changing the location.
Yes.
So that's, he's not, I don't think that's what it means to move your location, just because you're taking, you're still going to take your, you got yourself.
Yeah, you got yourself. Wherever I go, there I am, right?
Right.
Well, the funny thing is that they did mean it literally, Tibetans. But, I, you know, we're going to get into that with the commentaries. They really did mean, but what they meant was go off in a cave and practice Dharma, which is not really what we usually do when we pack everything up and move. I have friends in France. When I was in France like 40 years ago, and I stayed with these friends, and they literally, if they had an, they knew a lot of people because their apartment was like, it was like a Grand Central Station. I mean, there were always 10 people staying there. Anybody who wanted a place to stay could stay with them. So there's always like people sleeping all over the floor. So they knew a lot of Americans, and they said any address they had for an American that was more than 2 years old, they crossed it out because they knew they weren't there anymore. People in Europe do not move with the frequency that we do. But so we Americans are the restless people, which is where we came from, right? We people who trampled over the indigenous culture here. We invaders. We were moving to try to find a better place where we could be better people and find what we wanted and not have those problems that we had back in Bavaria or wherever. Did it work? We went all the way to California. I mean, really, you can kind of see, like, the more east you are, the sort of more European you still are, and the more you move to California, it's like California is the place where, I don't know, that's like the, it's like the limit of mental restlessness or something. You know, this is as far as we could go without falling off into the ocean. So the people who are the most sort of restless and needed new, more, this is totally my own personal, you know, opinion. But it's my experience of California that the most out there people who didn't find what they needed anywhere further east, like that's where they ended up. So it's a really different culture, say, from East Coast culture. But are they more free of problems than we are? Deirdre, did you have something to say?
Yes, they are more free of problems.
Yes, as a Californian, you can say that directly.
but I could say that in some ways they are free of some, and in other ways they're encumbered by more. But
yeah,
that's not what I was going to say.
Can I ask you something before you get to what you say?
Yeah, yeah.
Did your family, when you were young, sail around the world or something?
Yeah.
Well, did you take your problems with you?
I think we left a lot of distractions behind, and we became more aware of others throughout the world and adapting. And I think that by getting away from your homeland, you open yourself up in a way of trusting the world. And especially if you're out on a boat and you're confronted with 40-foot seas,
yeah,
and there's no one there to rescue you, you really have a different outlook on life.
You're like in the cave. That's the cave.
Yeah, so I can say that I think, yeah, it was definitely a different way of growing up and gave me a bigger, a more open idea of the world and people and more accepting of differences.
But you did the thing. I mean, you gave up the distractions. I mean, that's what it's really about. You gave up all of your routines and distractions. Mm-hmm. Take them with you because they didn't fit on your boat.
Right. I've done it before as an adult also, been at sea for 30 days. And it's true. That's when all your stuff and everybody else's stuff comes out. And every time everybody gets into port, you see the dinghy hit the water and all the duffel bags and everything come out. And everybody tries to find a different boat to go on because they're sick of the people that they're with.
Yes. Three-year retreat is like that too, only you don't.
You can't get off. You can't bail.
But anyway, what were you going to say?
The way I look at the darkness of ignorance and having, you have friends and enemies, and when one of those is not in your face, that's kind of your reality. So when your friend is in your face, you don't really think about your enemies. When your enemies are in your face, you don't really think about your friends. But then there's that whole rest of civilization and beings that are also there that we don't notice at all. So I think as a aspiring bodhisattva, when you find a place of peace and there's lots of friends around, you may not think to, oh, there's no problem with samsara. Samsara is okay.
Right.
You know? And then you see somebody suffering. And then it's like, oh, that I was so indifferent to even thinking about that person while I was enjoying this bounty of samsara, you know. So yeah. To me, that was kind of the message here, is that when you're occupied with like and dislike, there's a whole group being left out by, if not just even contemplating them, about
yeah.
them.
Yeah, well, there's your indifference. I mean, in a sense, there's your indifference. And that's why when we do metta or maitri or loving kindness meditation, we start with a person that we love.
Right.
And then we go to a person. You can do different orders, but it's a person that you love, then a person that you have an aversion to, and you try to generate loving kindness for them. And then there's the person you don't know, that you don't care about, your mail carrier, or just somebody that you maybe are kind of aware of, but you really don't attribute like a personality to them. You don't have a relationship with them. They don't bring up any reaction in you particularly. And that's the ignorance part, or the ignorance part. Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking more of the ones that we absolutely don't want to see, because it's, mm-hmm. you know, like you don't want to see Syrian refugees, and you don't want to see, you don't want to think about that happening. Yeah. You want to live in your own little cozy cave and not think about anybody else as having a problem.
Yeah. So that's the delusion, right? That's you're like making yourself more deluded by denying, you know, that this problem exists. And so dark delusion, I mean, I could translate that differently, because dark delusion almost sounds like a paranoia or something, but it really just means the thickness. It's darkness in the Tibetan, but also just means thickness. It's stupidity. It's what they call stupidity. There's like, when we talk about ignorance, ignorance itself, and this is the best I understand it, and I've seen it explained this way. Ignorance, in fact, it's explained in something that we're studying. Maybe it's for KDC. It must be in the jewel ornament, right? Ignorance is defined as not being aware of your true nature, right? And stupidity or darkness or timok, delusion, is not being aware that you're not aware of it. Like you think this is reality. So yeah, so by denying, you know, things that are really out there that would be unpleasant for us to think about or would, you know, stir our emotions, we just pile on the delusion. So it's not a safe place either. All right, we should go on to the next verse, but does anybody have anything that they would like to add before we do that? All right. So, I mean, by the next verse, I mean the commentaries on this verse, of course. Let us look first at, Dingo Chensei. This is the one that everybody read. We're just going to look at the highlights of that a little bit, because I want to read you the Ken MacLeod in case not everybody has that. And if we have time, we'll look at Pema Chodron. And if even if we don't read her, she has an interesting thing to add. So the three poisons, I'm on page 63, the three poisons generally speaking, are most active in the relationships you establish with family and friends in your own homeland. There it is all too easy for the protection of those to whom you are attached and the increasing of their wealth and happiness to become your main preoccupation. This is Tibetans. Very rural, 14th century Tibet. People don't travel around. You know, it's not like us now. We can just zip to California or zip to Timbuktu, you know, at the drop of a hat and back and forth and all over the place. They were just in one place mostly. Even nomads were together with their family wherever they went. You know, they packed up, but they always took everything with them. So their attachments and aversions were really rooted in a place and rooted in the people in that place. So packing up and going to a cave, or even packing up and going to a different place, you actually might break, you know, some of those tight bonds that bring up the habitual emotional reactions. You actually might get some space even if you don't go to a cave. But I think here, not so much. But anyway, so his point here is that in our homeland, in our home, in the comfort of our home where we've lived for our whole entire life with the same people, our life is all about taking care of this person's interests, making sure this person gets what they want, you know, exploring this with that person, you know, having our routines with that person and so on and so forth. Let's see. Right, so and he goes into more detail about how the habit builds up and so forth. So he says, and this is on page 64, halfway down the page, after he talks about our competitors. So we have like a more adversarial relationship with certain people. But again, you go through the same thing again and again with the same person, always the same thing. It just makes the habit deeper and deeper and deeper. So rather than stay near the people and things that are liable to arouse your attachment and resentment, go to a completely unknown place where there is nothing that will engender negative emotions. Your mind will not be disturbed and you will be able to devote your time and energy to the practice of Dharma. So I think maybe that worked well. Yes, Richard, let me unmute you. Hold on.
I was just thinking, This is assuming there are no other people, right? Because as soon as there are other people, you're going to get those same habits again.
Right. I think he's not necessarily, because he says, just go to a completely unknown place where there is nothing that will engender negative emotions. I think that you could theoretically, like what he's saying, a cave is ideal. So that's definitely what a lot of them did. But I think he's not ruling out that you just change places. Because
when you go somewhere and you don't know anybody, you eventually get those attachments.
Eventually, yeah. You do. But he's talking about somebody. This is all about somebody who's aspiring to be a bodhisattva. Like that's what they want. They want to awaken their mind. So for ordinary people, moving, no, it doesn't help at all. But for a Dharma person, like we could also fall into that trap. And we do, you know, to some degrees. But if our motivation is to get away from attachment and aversions that have built up, in order to free ourselves to engage in Dharma practice, then I think we have some tools to not build it up again.
True, true. Okay.
But what does that mean, though? Like, what does that mean? That means that even if we stayed home, we could stay home.
Yeah.
Same motivation. I think it's easier if you move, because it takes a while to build up the friendships and the, you know, get to know the boss and all that, you know, the coworkers. So you get a bit of a fresh start, but if your motivation is really strong, you could do it at home. And I think we all do that to some extent because we're all practitioners. We do like what the Jewel Ornament calls, you know, isolating the body and isolating the mind. We know how to do that. We have our corner where we do our practice and we do that every day. And that gets us out of the fray. This is going to be verse 3. This is like looking ahead to verse 3 where we remove ourselves from distractions. And what happens if you're a Dharma practitioner, your practice fills up that space. And that's how you save yourself from just getting into the same habits over and over again. So it's all a question of mental motivation. Valerie, something?
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. Couldn't this moving around be interpreted as a mental moving around, like mentally?
It's actually all about mental. It's all about mental, really. It's not expressed that way in the verse, but that's the key. It's your mind is the one that you can either in your mind remove yourself from habits and distraction, or you can engage. We have that choice. And if you're going to engage, it doesn't matter where you are or if you move. John, did you have something?
Yeah, I was going to say, isn't this why we go on retreat? To get away from our stuff?
Yeah, this is why we go on retreat. And so that is moving. Like, we could do retreat at our home, but isn't it easier to do retreat if you go somewhere else to a retreat where it's all set up for you? Richard, did you have something?
No.
Oh, I just forgot to mute you again. I'm muting you. It's just because the reason is because sometimes there's background noise. You didn't have any that I noticed. Valerie, did you have something else? And then
Patrick? When you go to retreat, you're like, people, I feel like I try harder, you know, like than if I'm here because nobody's watching me.
Yeah. Yeah. So it is easy. So I think we're figuring out some things here about what this verse can mean to us as practitioners. Patrick?
Is that on?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is he trying to make a case for going to a monastery and these things?
No, monasteries are not places.
People that monastery are could do it. Did they take the Bodhisattva vow as part of a monastic life?
You know, if you remember his life story a little bit, monastery was not the place for him. He got out of monastery as soon as he could. He was the abbot of a monastery, and then they wanted him to be the abbot of another monastery, and he said, nope, I'm going to go and be in retreat. I'm going to be by myself. So he did the thing. I think any place, a monastery, any kind of a retreat, a monastery, but as we know vividly from being involved with our monastery for so many years, you can certainly develop those habits and reactions in that place. And you see people all the time who have been monastics for many years who are still subject to emotional reactivity. So I think the lesson of this is any place can be a place where you either progress on the Dharma path by cutting, you know, through that reactivity, or it can be a place that engenders the reactivity. It's really all up to us.
So it's maybe not really about a place. But why would this be number two? Why is it such a prominent instruction if it really doesn't matter?
That's a good question. I see that you have something to say, and then we'll get back to that question.
I interpret it as a tool at the beginning that you would do because we are so immersed in our distractions and our habits and in our reactions. So you remove yourself from that until your practice becomes strong enough that you can go back and mentally remove yourself from the fray. And so it's helpful at the beginning. And they say that when you're learning to meditate, you should go away to someplace quiet.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's it. And I'll go ahead. Did you have more?
No.
I'm just going to say before I get back to you, Patrick, Pema Chodron actually answers this a little bit in her commentary, which is just my own personal notes. She says that the first few verses, leaving your homeland, relying on solitude, and giving up attachment to this life, are they're all advice on how to become less entangled. How to start to remove ourselves, you know, into a sort of frame of mind where we actually can engage in the Bodhisattva practices. And in his textual outline in his book, Dengo Chensei says the first seven verses are the preparation or the preliminary. So leaving your homeland in probably for us a metaphorical sense. What it is really is the same thing that we're studying in the meditation paramita, in the jewel ornament, isolation of the body, isolation of the mind. So you can isolate your body to a smaller degree or a larger degree. It might just be you have a place in your house to go meditate, but you have to isolate your mind. Isolation of the mind has to happen, and it can happen anywhere. It's just easier if you pack up sometimes and go off on a retreat. So I'm going to go on, unless anybody else has anything that they need to say right now. I'm going to go on so we get to the Ken MacLeod. Right. So he seems to be saying, go to a completely unknown place. And I think that was, like, for Tibetans, it was really rooted in their home. And just walking away from the home, you know, it's not like somebody's going to come after you because people don't really travel. They're busy taking care of the yaks. You really could just get up and move, but your motivation for that would not be a samsaric motivation. Your motivation for that would specifically be to break these habits and reactions. And that's why I put that into the verse. Because I think for us as Westerners, that's it's really the metaphorical application, without which the physical change doesn't matter. So he goes on to say, there's some very nice verses here that you can read if you haven't read this section yet. basically, he says of all kinds of entanglements in samsara, throw them all away. Seized by fear, throw them all away, because the fear is the fear of the six realms, the fear of, you know, karma and all that. Once you have left home, country, family, friends, and worldly work behind, you will have nothing to cling to. You will feel as free as the birds and wild animals. Oh, but wait, are the birds and wild animals free? They are not. They are, you know, they got their rebirth through the poison of ignorance. But he, again, here he doesn't mean like ultimate. We're talking relative. Like, doesn't it look like the birds are free and the wild animals are free? Really, they have a lot of suffering, but he just means how it will feel to us. This is a feeling tone, as Ken McLeod would say. If however, okay, and here it is. Here's what everybody has already, the conclusion everybody came to independently. If, however, in your new and initially unfamiliar surroundings, you begin to forge new attachments, you will once again find that you are unable to practice the Dharma. So, and this is what Mingyur Rinpoche did, right? So like the moon, which is always on the move, do not remain in one place too long. And that's what they did. They didn't set up shop in one cave, mostly they didn't. Like Milarepa went to different caves and so forth. They get too familiar and settled into one place, they pack up and they go to another cave. And that's what Mingyur Rinpoche did in his 4 years of retreat where nobody knew who he was. He wandered from place to place, from cave to cave. So let's see. So through our Dharma practice, basically, and this is the last sentence of the commentary on this verse, so too the pointlessness of becoming attached to anyone and anything will become obvious, and you will see that all objects of attachment are like things perceived in dreams, like phantasmagoric illusions. How many books do we see phantasmagoric in? That's a pretty good word. Oops. So sorry, it's just remuting. All right, so that's Dingo Chensei's commentary, and we are going to look now at Ken McLeod's, if anybody has the Silver River book. And Kathy made an impassioned, you know, advertisement for that book last week. Kathy Rogers, who couldn't be with us this week because she's visiting a sick friend in New Jersey, said that this book, Silver River, speaks to her in a way that the Dingo Chensei commentary doesn't, because it's from a Western point of view and she connects directly with the way that Ken presents it. So that could be a very helpful book to have if you don't have it, but it's not required. And I will probably be reading from his commentary every week. So the way that he translates the verse is, attractions to those close to you catches you in its currents. Aversion to those who oppose you burns inside. Indifference that ignores what needs to be done is a black hole. I'm not sure about that line, Ken, but I think I know what he means. It's a black hole. You get sucked into a black hole. That's like delusion, right? That is like dark delusion, I guess. Leave your homeland. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. So his commentary is fairly short. I think we have time to read it all. Do you really have to move to another country in order to practice? Perhaps you have already gone to a retreat or a meditation program on the other side of the world, but you probably bought a round-trip ticket. You arrive at your retreat full of enthusiasm, unpack your carry-on, set up your meditation cushion and roll out your yoga mat. After a couple of days, you discover a few unwanted items came with you, items that you do not remember packing. During breaks, you flirt with the person who sits in front of you. You find the person who sits on the cushion beside you unbearable. All right, everybody who's ever been to a retreat, bring that to mind. Why did he have to sit right there? Why does he have to wear such bright colors? Others you just ignore because you do not need them and you expect they feel the same way about you. So we have all three of the three poisons there. The food, your accommodations, and even the scenery you like or dislike, or it fails to move you one way or another. And here I'm going to insert, like for everybody who's somewhat familiar with the five skandhas, like the first skandha is just having a body, like there's something there. Second skandha is this. It's every single, like having a body means that we have divided our world, our perception into self and other. So once that is in place, that first skandha, there's all this stuff out there that's not us, and we relate to every single thing we encounter in one of three ways. It's pleasant, I like it. It's unpleasant, I want to avoid it. Or it's neutral, I really don't have a feeling about it one way or another. Those are the three, like those three things are in this verse. Those we love, those we hate, and those we feel indifferent towards, or our indifference, our choice to be indifferent. Really useful, and that's going to be part of the homework, is as you go through the next week, notice that level of reaction to things. You know, you probably notice it when you have a full-blown emotion about it, which is getting to be the third and fourth skandhas. You know, third skandha is sort of, it becomes defined. Like, it's not just an unpleasant sensation, it's like a ginkgo tree fruit, something that smells bad. Or it's not just a pleasant sensation, that's the smell of a rose. That's the third skandha. Fourth is emotionality about it. Like, I really hate roses. You know, I just can't stand roses. I just roses everywhere I go. That's the fourth skandha. So you're probably going to catch yourself in the third or the fourth skandha, either defining or having a strong emotional reaction. But you can dial it back. So when you find yourself in that emotion, or that judgment or opinion about something, dial it back to just feeling it as a pleasant or unpleasant or neutral thing. And notice as much as you can during this week. I mean, it's a constant thing that happens because we constantly encounter things on TV, in real life, in our thoughts. Notice the level of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And that is what in the next skandha, the third skandha, perception, turns into attachment, aversion, and indifference, or indifference, or denial, or whatever you want to call it. So back to Ken. So to repeat that sentence, the food, your accommodations, even the scenery, you either like it, you dislike it, or it fails to move you. Attraction, aversion, and indifference, the three poisons. You traveled thousands of miles to be free from them, and here they are now as if you had never left home. These basic patterns poison your life. That's why they call them the poisons. You cannot just enjoy something, you have to have it. And that brings me back to a discussion that we had at KDC a couple of weeks ago about, well, you know, if it's, you know, because the antidote to excessive attachment to something in meditation is to think of its unpleasant aspects. And Patrick said, well, you know, does that mean you can't appreciate beauty? And it was a really good question. And no, and Ken's saying that here too. You can't just enjoy something. You can't, we as samsaric beings, we can't just stop at thinking, oh, that's really beautiful. It's like, it's really beautiful. How much does that cost? And do I have enough money? And can I, you know, I'm going to die if I don't get it. That's attachment. But appreciation, just acknowledging, is fine. And that makes a very nice life. So you can't just enjoy something, you have to have it. You can't just meet a challenge, you have to oppose it. You can't just relax, you have to check out. These poisons pull you out of present experience and into the past, an eternal limbo in which you forever seek the love you always wanted and fight with the ghosts of those who stood in your way. So our current emotional reactivity patterns echo patterns that we, from our past experience, they you know, we fall into the same, you know, reactions again and again, and we don't even know why, but it comes from something in our past. When nothing touches you, that's that third one, your indifference creates a distance between you and the world around you. You check out, you become dulled, you become admired. It is not so easy to leave your homeland. There are other possibilities. Let's see, we have 10 minutes left. So he's giving us here, if we feel emotional reactivity arising, there are things we can do. So this is worth remembering, and I will list these. I'm not going to write it all out, but I'll list these in my update email for people who weren't here. The first thing you can do when you notice pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, bring attention to the feeling tones that accompany every sensory experience. Notice if it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Feel how those three reactions, attraction, aversion, and indifference, feel how they move in you. They are fast. They are insistent. They are insidious. As you keep doing this, your relationship with the three poisons gradually changes. As you keep catching it at that level, like noticing it, ah, there it is, pleasant. Oh, there it is, aversion. Oh, there it is, I'm escaping by having this ice cream or whatever. So that's the first thing, is just pay attention to it. Second, when you feel attraction starting to run, breathe in and take in the same attraction, first from everyone you know, then from everyone in the world. So that, you know, again, this is a mind training text and this is a mind training slogan. This is the slogan, this is the post-meditation slogan, the real life activity slogan that goes with Tonglen itself, with taking and sending. It's a version of taking and sending. So you feel attraction, we'll just take on everybody's attraction. Breathe it in. And the slogan in mind training is, can I bring the words to mind? Three objects, three poisons, three somethings. Darn. Three objects, three poisons, three somethings.
Remedies.
It's not remedies. It's not the word. That's not the word, but it is that. That's what it is. So we're going to use that as the placeholder. Three objects, three poisons, three remedies. Three ways to turn it into Dharma practice. So you can do this with any emotion. You feel anger coming up. You feel attraction coming up. You feel indifference and checking out and shutting out coming up. You breathe in that emotion as it's experienced by everybody in the world. You just breathe it in and you think you're freeing them from it. And you can breathe out to them then, you know, something good if you want. Valerie, what did you have to say?
I was in the city yesterday and there's a lot of homeless people right next to a lot of very, very rich people. There was this guy, very terribly homeless, right outside this fancy coffee store. So these people are coming out with their $5 cup of coffee, right? Many of them in and out. And I was thinking, maybe somebody should buy him a coffee? Would Tan Lane have been the way to deal with that?
It's one way. You got to use your judgment in these situations. You could have bought him a cup of coffee, but sometimes you know whether to do that or not.
Right.
You buy them some food, like engage them. But even Lama Norla says sometimes that can, you know, they might be a person who's mentally ill or something, and you engage them. That's happened to me in New York City. You engage them and they punch you. That literally happened to me back in the 80s. So you just use your judgment, your intuition. But yes, when you can't do something to actually alleviate someone's suffering physically, you can do Tonglen. You can always do Tonglen. And so this is using Tonglen to remedy your emotional reactivity. You feel a reaction coming up. So this is an internal thing. You're noticing your own reaction coming up, and you take on everybody's emotion. It's a way of expanding to benefit all beings, to be on team other instead of being stuck on team self. So you do that. And then he says, what do you have to lose? The attraction is already running in you. You are already messed up. You're already suffering from being angry yourself. So you might as well take on the anger of the whole world and free everybody else. It's a very effective way to deal with an emotion that, you know, that is troubling you. You might as well take in the poison from others and set them free. Ditto for aversion, ditto for indifference. So the third option, and again, I'm going to recap these in my email. When you see something or someone you like, And this is very similar, really, to like just the meditative methods that we get in the jewel ornament and so forth. So the third way to deal with this emotional reaction that's coming up when you catch it, when you see someone or something you like or don't like, really, open to the whole experience, the person or the object and the attraction in you. So whether it's a person you're tempted to fall in love with or want something from, whether it's a beautiful, you know, tchotchke or whatever, something you would like to have, a rug, open to the whole experience, the person or object and the attraction in you. With attraction, you are aware of every detail in the person or the object. Rest right there. You are just enchanted by this thing. Rest right there. Maybe you're looking at a painting in a museum and you feel it. You just really connect with it. Rest right there. Open yourself up to that, how that feels. With aversion, so now it's something you don't like. With aversion, your mind becomes very clear. Rest there. With indifference, you are aware of everything. Rest there. I'm not sure I would have to analyze that one, but, you know, with indifference, you are aware of everything. I don't know what he means by that exactly, but we can talk about that next week. When you are able to experience these poisons and not act on them, you have left your homeland. Boom. That's it. When you are able to experience attachment, attraction, aversion, hatred, or catch yourself choosing to be indifferent and ignore something, and you don't act on it. Attraction, you don't have to go after the thing because you're looking at the reaction in yourself instead. Aversion, you don't have to lash out at the person or say something or do something. You just watch yourself going through this mental show. You have left your homeland when you can do that. And he ends the chapter by saying, I don't know if you can see that. Safe travels? Not likely. This is on my Kindle. All right. I think that was a really great chapter. And I'm just going to tell you, we have 3 minutes left, so we got to do our prayers because I promised that we will end on time. But if we do go a minute or two past and somebody has to leave, please just do it. No problem. So Pema Chodron, when she taught this last year, she used Ken's book as her main book. And she said that she would call it leaving your comfort zone. Step outside your comfort zone into the challenge zone. So the comfort zone, and this is my explanation because that's all she said basically, is like your habitual way of dealing with things. It's just the easy way to proceed. When we like something, we go after it. When we hate something, we oppose it. That's our comfort zone. So step out of that zone. That is leaving your homeland. She says, the learning takes place not in the comfort zone, but in the areas where you stretch. All right, we're going to have to stop there. Let me see if I wrote a note about homework. Yeah, just notice the feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Again, this will be in the email. And apply Tonglen and apply all of those methods. And we're going to do verse 3 next week, but we can start with it, you know, if anybody has anything further to say about verse 2, we can start with that next week. I think we've covered it pretty well. I do want to chant it together. So we're going to do that, and then we're going to do our prayers, and we will be done. So we're going to chant verse, since we only have two, we're going to do verse 1, and then we're going to do verse 2 3 times. Takes a minute and a half. This precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat to navigate samsara's endless sea and set myself and other beings free for that without distraction day and night to study, contemplate, and meditate. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. While those I love can stir up a tsunami, and those I hate can burn me up like fire, when I don't care, I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind. To give up all my habits and reactions, this homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. I think we're going to leave it there and just do the prayers because it is 2:30. So we're going to do our dedication of merits. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangho, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate all virtue fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate, the blessings of the Buddha Kayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. And we're going to just let our minds come to rest in that open awareness, which is very close to just resting in the nature of our own mind. Open awareness of the present moment. All right, I apologize again for the glitch that caused us to start so late, but it was a good learning curve for me, and hopefully next week we'll have a good experience. I thank all of you for coming, and I'm really happy that we're having some good discussion, because to me that's the most helpful way to internalize the Dharma, is to really think about it and talk together as a group. Valerie, did you have something to say?
No, I was just going to say goodbye.
Okay. All right. I guess we should get off now. Thank you so much, everybody. And, oh, please pray for Scarlett Sams, our Sangha member who died today.
Thank you, Lama.
See you next week.
Thank you.
I'm going to exercise the superpower so nobody has to do anything.